You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Harold Trinkunas. I direct the Latin America Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program here at the Brookings Institution. It's my pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to an opportunity to release my colleague Vanda Felbab-Brown's new paper, Changing the Game or Dropping the Ball, Mexico's Security and Anti-Crime Strategy under President Enrique Peña Nieto. This is a new paper that's based on field research that Vanda recently conducted in Mexico. Vanda, as some of you may know, is a recognized expert on issues of conflict, illicit economies, organized crime, and counterinsurgency, and she's focused on all parts of the world, but she has spent a considerable amount of time thinking about the situation in Mexico. So I'll ask her to lead off our discussion with a review of some of her findings, after which I'll ask my dear colleague, Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, to offer some comments on the paper. Duncan joined the Mexico Institute relatively recently, within the last couple of years, but before that was a professor at ITAM, one of Mexico's leading universities, where he directed the International Relations Program. He has a long and distinguished career, very familiar with the situation in Mexico, so I'm looking forward to a great discussion. And once our two speakers have had a chance to make some comments, then I'll open it up to the floor for discussion. But to get us there first, Vanda, why don't you lead us off?
Thank you. Good afternoon. We are meeting here today after a several days of a interesting campaign in Mexico on Twitter, which played off the words, somewhat unfortunate words, of Mexico's Attorney General saying, "I'm tired," at the grueling conference discussing the events in Iguala and the massacre of students there, or disappearance, presumed massacre of students there. At the end of the conference, he sort of ended by saying, I am tired, which was picked up on social media and started a big campaign with many Mexican people, NGOs, activists saying, well, we are tired with the violence, we are tired with impunity. And the reason why this is an interesting moment is because the Peña Nieto administration came into power at the time where there was very much of a sense in Mexico that the Mexican public was tired with the violence and was tired with the preoccupation on security issues in Mexico. And so President Peña Nieto very much responded to a mood that among the public that wanted to focus on economic issues, on social issues, something that he has made key priorities of his agenda. And that has not meant that the administration stopped focusing on the issue of security, but certainly tried to approach it in a different way than the administration of President Felipe Calderón, his predecessor. And the second irony, of course, is that in many ways, although the initial rhetoric of the Calderón administration was one of doing things differently than in the security domain than the administration of President Felipe Calderón, in many ways, many of the policies adopted were very similar, if not identical, to the policies of his predecessor, primarily with law enforcement, policing being essentially defined as high-value targeting. At the same time, of course, his administration has had to confront the lack of security and the fundamental misgovernance in central part of Mexico, in Michoacán, with the rise of militias there, and recently in Guerrero. During the Calderón era, the hotspots of violence and the key focus of media were places like Tijuana and Ciudad Juárez and ultimately Monterrey. Areas where violence has gone substantially down, although it's been rising in Tijuana. And to a large extent, that has happened not as a result of government policy, or not fundamentally as a result of government policies, but as a result of the criminal market being carved out once again among criminal groups, with the Sinaloa cartel being the victor in many areas, including in Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez. But meanwhile, for a variety of reasons, unsettled balances of power, unsettled divisions, turf, as well as a result of the high-value targeting policy being the predominant law enforcement response, violence has escalated in new areas like Tamaulipas, and the Peña Nieto administration has been very much playing a catch-up mode, putting out fires there, while continuing some of the undesirable side effects, or facing some of the undesirable side effects of high-value targeting, namely that it generates so much instability among the criminal groups that they have the capacity to easily replace the leaders, but at the same time, succession wars are triggered. And so, ironically, some of the key policies that were stimulating violence during the Calderon years continued being adopted, continue to be adopted by the Peña administration, even as much as they have wanted to change the game and perhaps even walk away from the security issues. At the same time, much of the momentum on police reform arguably dissipated or was misdirected. Calderon administration focused very much on federal police, and progress was made there, but it's hardly resolved, and the federal police continues to be challenged. His agenda of focusing on police reform on the sub-state level was stalled for a variety of reasons, including the role of the PRI in the Mexican Congress. Now, the Peña people had the chance to really pick up momentum on particularly state and local police, have chosen to leave it up to states, Mexican states, whether they want to combine the local and state police, with the effect being essentially a lack of momentum, stalled, unresolved local policing and local governance issues. And they are really at the core of the tragedies and the drama unfolding in Guerrero and Michoacán. Continually poor governance and particularly poor law enforcement at the local level, with the state as well as the federal capital being far removed and only paying attention when these fires blow up. And so perhaps the important outcome of the massacres and tragedy in both in Guerrero as well as the preceding growth of militias and their very visible manifestation in Michoacán, Guerrero, and elsewhere is that both the government, the federal government, and the Mexican people will realize that the public security issues are not one of choice, but they are of deep institutional deficiencies and institutional collapse and hollowing out that will take far more than simply one presidency to be resolved, and that the momentum needs to be maintained. That doesn't mean that social and economic issues should be neglected, but at the end of the day, a fundamental rebalancing of power needs to take place between the state and the criminal groups, between the criminal groups and Mexican society, and that rebalancing has not yet happened. Even in the north, where violence has gone down, it has largely gone down as a result of new balances of power being established in the criminal market. And the peace is unfortunate peace, though the reduction in violence is hardly peace, is very much at the discretion of the criminal groups, who continue to be still in a very strong position vis-a-vis the state. And fundamental law enforcement deterrence capacity continues to be lacking in law enforcement in Mexico. And that is a long process, and it's a process that needs to be maintained. And even if violence goes down, that doesn't mean then that the government should stop focusing on those areas, but instead become creative and engaged and take opportunities of the narco peace to change the narco peace into being an actual peace, not simply a reduction in violence at the discretion of criminal groups. Along with that, of course, needs to come a very strong focus on addressing political corruption, which has many causes in Mexico, and there are many structural as well as non-structural reasons for it. It's hardly a new phenomenon. But along with this change of power accumulating far more on the side of the criminal groups, the balance of power between politicians and criminal groups has also changed, where the nature of corruption has changed, where the criminal groups often dictate to local politicians what they can do, particularly in places like Guerrero, like Michoacán, like Chiapas, even in areas that are not so visibly violent, but where nonetheless the state is fundamentally weak and where the susceptibility of local politicians to coercion or to corruption from criminal groups remains high. And here, again, there is a very fundamental role for the federal state or for states in Mexico to back up municipal politicians. So as much as one needs to demand accountability, along with that accountability also needs to come support, because it's very easy to succumb to pressure if the outcome is that yet another mayor in Mexico will be murdered as a result of pressure from organized crime. I would make one final comment on socioeconomic anti-crime programs that I discuss in great detail in the report, along with various strategies, such as building up new institutions like the Gendarmerie, such as high-value targeting and its meaning and effects. Along with this basic thrust and focus on social issues and economic reforms in Mexico, the Peña administration also embraced crime prevention and socioeconomic programs to combat crime. And it's very praiseworthy. That was often lacking during the Calderón administration, and even to the extent that the policies were adopted, like Todos Somos Juárez, they often were adopted belatedly. Nonetheless, the design of the so-called polygonos approach, that the hallmark of the crime prevention socioeconomic approaches to anti-crime issues of the Peña Nieto administration, requires some examinations. And I think there are many opportunities to improve those programs. The Calderón people, when they found, when they finally adopted socioeconomic approaches, focused almost the entire effort on Ciudad Juárez. It came out of a particular political crisis, a particular massacre in Ciudad Juárez. The outcome was then a very large financial package called Todos Somos Juárez. And in many ways, concentrating resources is the key issue that Mexico needs to do in combating organized crime, whether it's concentrating law enforcement resources or socioeconomic resources. But it is very hard to do in a democracy, because at the end of the day, why is one community, however much suffering, deserving of such large state interventions and others are not? And so the Peña people said, well, yes, socioeconomic programs are important, crime prevention important, and we need to spread it throughout other parts of Mexico, with the outcome, of course, being that the financial intervention for each of the so-called polygonos, the areas of intervention, being very limited with its ability to then change, transform the local environment being very limited. Another difficulty and challenge for the polygonos approach is that it's often very fragmented as well as very amorphous. Precisely because of the pressure of a democracy to give each community a little bit as opposed to concentrate resources, the outcome tends to be, well, let's give a school orchestra here, let's give a perhaps a road over there, but how they connect to each other, how they congeal, to what extent they can have a transformative effect beyond being a handout is a big question mark. And all too often they become sort of feel-good measures, such as giving children in the school the opportunity to play on the sports team. I have absolutely nothing against children being given opportunities to engage in extracurricular activities, and indeed it can strengthen their sense of self-worth and accomplishment. But nonetheless, one needs to ask how out of the kids that go on the soccer team, how many will end up being criminals later on, having played soccer or having played on a school orchestra, now playing violin, or how many will not have been criminals to start with, even in the absence of not having been on the soccer team or part of the school orchestra. So this, lots of these programs are appealing in their own sake, but the link to them being anti-crime measure 20 years later or so, it's often very questionable, and the ability to monitor and evaluate their meaning beyond being a political handout is often very elusive and something that needs to be sharpened. The logic of the criminal, of these anti-crime socioeconomic programs, especially those focused on children and youth, needs to be made far more explicit, in my view, than it is. And it also has to be linked to policing. And one of the big thrusts of the report and the title, Changing the Game or Dropping the Ball, is that, yes, reducing violence is a key priority for Mexico. It is the right objective. The Calderón administration was too dismissive of the violence level, saying they don't matter because it's criminals killing criminals. It was a wrong attitude to have. The violence had absolutely devastating effects on social fabric in Mexico. Violence needs to be brought down. But how one goes about it equally matters. And along with that, there is no escape from good policing. And the Peña Nieto administration can really redouble its efforts and focus far more than it's done so far on thinking about what policing needs to look like in a place where violence has gone down, like Ciudad Juárez. How policing needs to be married with interdiction policy, so that if a capo is arrested, there is likely to be explosion in that regional area, how that can be prevented by prepositioning of troops. How differently policing needs to be done in areas where the state is very sporadic, that has traditionally been captured by either problematic politicians or had a long history of rebellious groups, such as in the center of the country. And how policing needs to be married to the socioeconomic program. They are not replacement one for the other. So while changing the game is right in the sense of making reduction in violence a key objective, dropping the game by saying that law enforcement issues have been resolved or now it's time to focus on socioeconomic issues and not focus on law enforcement one is not the right take. Is not the right approach. And now with the drama over the past several weeks, I think there is very much of a momentum and recognition again that public safety requires good policing and opportunities for thinking how to do policing robustly and how to push on with effective police reform, as well as with giving real substance to the socioeconomic, broader anti-corruption, broader rule of law issues in Mexico.
Thank you, Vanda. I would be remiss if I didn't also note that Vanda is a scholar with our Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence, as well as affiliated with the Latin America Initiative, for whom she has provided this paper. Now I want to turn to Duncan Wood, Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, to provide some comments.
Thank you, Harold. And I'll use my indoor voice from now on. Better? Okay. Thank you, Harold. Thank you, Vanda, for the invitation to be here. First of all, just let me say that Vanda's paper is a very, very important contribution to our understanding here in Washington of what's actually going on in Mexico, providing the context of the last couple of years, as well as a deeper historical context. But I think that probably the most important thing about this paper is that it's Vanda that wrote it, and Vanda comes at this not as a Mexicanologa, not as somebody who's studied Mexico for years and years and years in general, but as somebody who's an expert in organized crime, somebody who's an expert on security. And that's what you brought to this. And I think that, you know, I know in the past people have criticized you for maybe being too sensationalist. Some people have said that, you know, you don't really understand Mexico. What you've done here is you've shown not only an incredible understanding for what's happening right now in Mexico, but you've brought in that perspective of somebody who can compare what Mexico is going through with situations around the world. That's a very, very valuable contribution. In addition to the field research that you did down there, you know, one of the things that I've always admired about you is the fact that you actually go out into the field. You put your feet where your mouth is, as it were. And that's a very, very important thing, and not many of us are willing to do that. So well done. Obviously, it's important to put this paper in the context of the recent tragic events, but also to separate out what's important recently in terms of the short-term versus the long-term impact. And I think that, you know, those of us who follow Mexico very, very closely, who are emotionally invested in Mexico, we see a lot of the daily news and the controversies and the scandals that have come out over the past couple of weeks, and we get carried away with them. We think, well, this is going to lead to some kind of governmental meltdown. It's very important to separate out what's important here from what isn't important. We've seen the scandals over the cancellation of the Chinese company's contract for a rail link between Querétaro and Mexico City. You've seen the scandals about the present wife's makeup artist tweeting from the presidential plane. You've seen various comments from the stepdaughter of the president about what is important, what isn't important. Try to forget all of that right now, because that's more to do with sort of day-to-day politics in Mexico and not so much about this incident. What is important, of course, about the recent tragic events in Mexico is what they teach us about the underlying conditions in the country. That's the context for everything that has happened and everything that is being described in Vanda's paper, which is the deep underlying institutional weakness that exists, not so much at the federal level, but very much so at the local and the state level. And of course, the diversity or the variety of levels of weakness, strength in institutions across the country. And so when you see that something like this happens in Iguala, Guerrero, or it happens in Michoacán, or it happens in Tamaulipas, that gives us an idea of what the institutional strength is at those local, at the local level in those places. And it helps us to understand why more of these things don't happen in places like Mexico City, for example, or in other parts of the country. Also very, very important to recognize the human element here, and I think that that's one of the things which is perhaps missing from the paper, because it's not really what you're trying to do, but to recognize the human dimension of security in Mexico. And that's what the experience of the past few weeks has really taught us, is that this is about people who live in rather random circumstances. They're not sure about whether if they go out to work, they're going to come home at the end of the day, or if their kids go off to school, are they going to see them at the end of the day? And that really has to be the priority of this. And again, this takes us to one of Vanda's most important conclusions about, do you target high-level individuals in organized crime? Is the battle against organized crime, or is the battle really for citizen security in Mexico? And it's very easy to conflate the two things and think that you're talking about the same thing, but you're not always. And that's why you have to be, I think, a lot more strategic in the way that you see Mexican security. The deep impact of the past few weeks in Mexico, and you see it as you follow social media, it's heartbreaking to see. It's heartbreaking from the personal point of view, and it's heartbreaking in terms of what the country is going through at this point in time. So, you know, obviously, our thoughts go out to all of those people directly involved and to Mexico in general. Vanda's critiques of the Peña Nieto security strategy, I think, are well-founded, and they go back to conversations that have been going on in Mexico and outside of Mexico since the very beginning. I mean, going back to January of 2013, when we first began to look at this and to say, well, what's the strategy here? We saw one word over and over again, which was coordination. And many of us who were observing and critiquing at the time said, coordination is an important factor, but it can't be the entire strategy. And we were waiting for more elements to come through, and they did come through. The Gendarmería was one of them. The Polígonos approach was another one. But yes, we did seem to fall back very, very quickly into just a continuation of Calderón's approach. The question is, and I think this is a very, very important question, as much as we can criticize the Mexican government for continuing that approach, what other alternatives are there? And this is where the level of institutions becomes abundantly clear. When you have limited institutional options, what can you actually do about a major situation like this? And so, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people who study Mexican security say, well, you should try to do something new. Well, there's not a lot new out there that you can actually do when you have very few institutions that actually do work. You have the federal police, you have the military, you have well-established cooperation with the United States. And then at the local level, when you look at your police forces, there are very few that are actually reliable. Vanda criticizes the Peña Nieto government for emphasizing a 50% drop in homicides during the first 6 months to 1 year. I think that, I mean, it's a fair criticism because the words are there, you know, on paper, they're out there. But the fact is that nobody actually believed that was going to happen, I don't think. And in fact, many of us were very surprised when the government was able to register around a 16% drop in homicides for its first year. Now, whether they were able to claim credit for that, your point is well made, Vanda, which is that we don't know if it was as a result of government strategy or whether battles had been fought and wars or individual wars had been won. You make the critique that maybe the strategy of targeting high-value individuals in organized crime was unthought through. Maybe so. But it's interesting, and you recognize this in your paper, that El Chapo's arrest has not led to a generalized spread of violence in the region controlled by the Sinaloa cartel. That organized crime group seems to have held together quite well, and we haven't seen a spread of the violence. So maybe it's not just, you know, the concept of high-value targeting. Maybe it's about what the underlying conditions are within the cartel, within the organized crime group. And I think a lot of people would make that argument with the Sinaloa cartel. It's structurally more robust than other cartels are, less dependent upon individuals. Using the military. I have to say that I think using the military is absolutely the right thing to do because that is an institution, both that people trust or have trusted in the past. It's obviously its levels of trust have taken a beating over the past few years, but also because you can actually mobilize the military across the country. Now, it's led to major problems with human rights abuses, and that's something which needs to be dealt with as well. But again, when you've got a limited array of or menu of options, maybe that's what you go with. The critique about police reform that you make is absolutely 100% on the mark. Absolutely. This is one of the things that we all recognize is fundamental, that Mexico needs to reform its police force. The federal government needs to work more closely with governors and with state-level governments to try to make sure that their police forces are more reliable, more effective. And, of course, we have the example in the state of Nuevo León of the Fuerza Civil, which was able to form a new police force, which is reliable, which does work. But unfortunately, like the Gendarmería, it's a very, very small force. I mean, you're looking at, I was talking to somebody in Monterrey the other day, and it's around 4,900 individuals who make up that police force, of which only 3,500 are actually police officers. It takes a long time to do this. It's very expensive, and it's very energy and financial resource intensive. Your critique of underfunded social programs, that the polígonos is a haphazard approach, again, I agree with you 100% here. In fact, I would go even further, which is that the government has missed a golden opportunity to make this a defining element of their administration. When they came in and they said, you know, coordination, the Gendarmería, and then we got to polígonos and the crime prevention program, we all stood up and said, that's exactly what you need to do, but how are you going to do it? And the government had some ideas, school programs, sports, et cetera, including making sure that every child in Mexico can see the blackboard that's in front of them in class and making sure that everybody has eye tests, which I always thought was a little bit of an exaggeration of the mandate of the Interior Ministry. Shouldn't that be the Education Ministry? But they believed it was important. Unfortunately, in my conversations with Gobernación, I've failed to detect any kind of impact evaluation concern on their part. And this is one of the elements that USAID has been pressing on them, but they don't seem to actually have a plan and a methodology for evaluating the impact of their programs with communities. This is something that we really need to push them even further on. A number of very positive contributions, Vanda, that you make towards the end of the paper, that we need vetted anti-kidnapping units. That's vital. I would say that the question of vetting should be generalized. We need to see this applied much more generally throughout Mexican security forces. And I would even say there's a golden opportunity at this point in time with the political reforms that we saw at the end of last year, that the new National Electoral Institute can begin to vet political candidates at the local and state level in a way they didn't have that authority before, which might possibly avoid this kind of problem in the future, given the fact that the mayor and his wife are so involved with organized crime. You've made the point that interdiction should be more strategic, absolutely, and that when there is a drop in violence, the government needs to stay around. One of the constant critiques, both of the Calderon administration and of this one, is that federal forces move in, they may resolve the immediate problem, but then they leave. You can't just leave that vacuum in place. A couple of suggestions of my own that I'd like to add here, which is that the community approaches, the community-based approach is going to become ever more important. I think we've seen this with the recent events and the public outcry in Mexico. You use the title, has the game changed? Did they drop the ball? I would say that actually the game in Mexico has changed from the last time that the PRI was in power. Now you see how strong civil society is, how willing civil society is to stand up and protest and to demand things from the government. And the PRI as a party has traditionally not had to deal with that. They've been able to bring in forces, social forces and opponents within their structure. That's not the game in Mexico. That has come to an end. So working with communities, making sure that there is an interactive dialogue with them is very, very important. And lastly, the opportunity that exists here, if it is appropriate to talk about opportunities, is that with society demanding more from the government, this is their opportunity to double down on the community-based approach to making sure that institutions at the local and state level are strengthened by working between the three levels of government, civil society, and the private sector. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Duncan, for those very thorough and thoughtful comments. We're going to go to the floor now for questions and answers. I'd ask folks to raise their hands. I'll keep a list. When there'll be microphones for people to speak into. So once I call on you, if you could just wait for the microphone to get to you, and if you could just state your name and institutional affiliation before you do so. And while I wait for some hands to rise, maybe I'll lead off with the first question. Vanda, I think one of the issues that you raise about police reform in Mexico is exactly how do you address the weakness of state and local police forces? One of the early proposals that I think observers were quite hopeful about in the Peña Nieto administration was this whole idea of a national gendarmerie. But over time, as we observed the administration come into office and get to work, that institution became smaller and smaller. The reforms were delayed. And maybe you could go into sort of, tell us a bit more about sort of why that proposal fell behind, because it seemed to me that compared to other situations we've observed in the region or even around the world, those nationally trained and overseen law enforcement units that have the kind of capacity and firepower to deal with heavily armed criminal organizations have proven to be a good solution in other places. What about Mexico?
My view is that the gendarmerie was, to some extent, a distraction, and distraction that dissipated energies. The key issue that Mexico needs to resolve is having good police forces with sufficient density permanently present throughout the territory. They can be part of a federal entity or national entity, but they certainly cannot be simply parachuted in when crisis breaks out. In order to get to know the criminals, one needs to get to know the community. That means having a sufficiently positive as well as sufficiently dense presence in local communities. I'm thinking, for example, about the Colombian Cuadrantes program, which has tried to do that. The results are not as optimistic as one would, or not as good as one was originally hoping. But the basic idea is that there needs to be police forces permanently stationed. And the gendarmerie was, in my view, distraction because it sort of sought to build a new institution, which would have been very difficult, where at the end of the day, it not ended up being a new institution, it ended up being into the federal police. The military forces refused to sacrifice further their bodies for supplying law enforcement. And it's not a new thing of the Calderón administration. For the past 2-3 decades, Mexico has dealt with police reforms by reaching into the military to staff various law enforcement institutions. And what, at the end of the day, happened with the gendarmerie that has been deployed is both deployed for anti-kidnapping. While not sure that's appropriate for the gendarmerie, you have specialized anti-kidnapping units that are just as good, probably much better responder for that kind of issue. Has certainly not been sent out to the areas where it was meant to be deployed, like Herero, like Michoacán, like Chiapas, where, well, Chiapas is more special because of the pre-existing density of police, but of military, but some of the central and southern states. It consumed tremendous amount of institutional energy and focus for delivering very little. I think that energy would have been better spent on either expanding the federal police or focusing on strengthening the mando único, perhaps not leaving it to states. But the basic fundamental issue is increasing the accountability, effectiveness, as well as density of local police forces. Whether one folds them into one national police force, like in Colombia, that's often brought as a model, or one continues to have a very fragmented law enforcement design, like the United States, in my view, is not the key issue. The key issue is addressing local policing in a far better way. And the gendarmerie, in my view, was not getting at that issue and has not got at that issue. And that continues to be one of the big holes of policing and law enforcement. The other comment I would make, also sort of responding to Duncan's comments, is not even so much a matter of building an institution or sending in the military. I agree there is no way to pull the military back right now. The question is, what purpose does one deploy them with? And whether this is the Calderon administration or the Peña administration, often whether it's the federal police or the military, they are deployed in with extremely vague mandates as to what they are actually supposed to do. What is the mission supposed to be? Are they supposed to go and round up the key criminal bosses in the neighborhood? Are they supposed to simply deter the visibility of violence because of their presence? And this continues to be unresolved in areas where violence has not broken out, like Chiapas or Quintana Roo, where violence has gone down, like the north, and the areas that are ablaze, Tamaulipas, Michoacán, Querétaro. So what is it that the police that are being inserted in are actually supposed to do in practical terms? And, you know, manning checkpoints and snarling at traffic on the road is arguably not the most effective way to use those forces.
A point about the Gendarmería, I think it was rather indicative that you have this idea of a rapid reaction force that goes in, that tries to solve a problem and then withdraws. That's not the issue in Mexico. And as I said earlier on, this is what people have been complaining about in rural areas in Mexico for a long time, which is that maybe the military is sent in, they calm down the violence, but then they leave. What you need to have a Gendarmería as part of a bigger strategy. And the strategy has to be, okay, you send in the Gendarmería as a rapid reaction force. And remember in the early days how it was, you know, a few months ago, they were talking about it as kind of an economic police force of some kind. That's fine. If there's an urgent need for that institution to go in and resolve an immediate problem, but then what happens? It's that next stage after the Gendarmería leaves that's the real challenge. How do you avoid this from happening again?
And they almost never resolve the issue. Perhaps, whether it's the federales or the gendarmerie or the military, perhaps their presence suppresses or deters violence, but it almost never resolves it. Adaptations might take place in the criminal market, like in the north, but they have a temporarily paused breathing effect. You can exhale, but then you need to think about how you design law enforcement on a permanent basis and what you need to do to get law enforcement to have a deterrence capacity, which continues to be fundamentally lacking in Mexico.
Absolutely. I believe, let's start here in the front row, and then Margaret, and then I got two more. In the room. Again, if you could just state your name and affiliation when you ask your question.
Bill Tucker, I'm an attorney and a consultant, and I've done a lot of work in Mexico. And my question is, why doesn't Mexico do more about the violence in northern New Mexico, where they know there's a tremendous oil field? The oil field in Texas that is producing 1 million barrels a day extends into northern Mexico. And Mexico needs the oil, they need the revenue, and why they wouldn't post the military or police, whatever they'd have to do to protect the oil companies that would go in and drill and produce this oil is beyond me. I just can't understand why a country would not do that and protect this natural resources that they have and they need. And both the U.S. and Canada have produced theirs and almost are energy independent. It's known that similar resources exist in Mexico. So why wouldn't the leadership produce it like they have in the U.S. and Canada?
Let me take a round of three or four and then come back to the panel.
Both of you have kind of lamented the lack of a consistent, coherent strategy, emphasized the need for community-based approaches, and I agree with that. I'd like you perhaps to address the challenges that federalism in Mexico poses to the success in making these choices and building national institutions versus local institutions. If we take the case of Juarez, that was really a local initiative on which the national government was able to build. But that tension in capacities, I think, is worth commenting on.
Thank you, Margaret. And I think let's take one more behind. Just two rows right there. Yes.
Hi, Miriam Hassan. I'm a consultant. And Wanda, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. First, there seems to be, I'm from Mexico, so one of the things that I have observed is that there is a lot of a class cut in terms of policing. Like, you go to neighborhoods where you have middle classes and in Mexico, and they seem to be secure. Yet other neighborhoods that are poor do not get the right security. We see Monterrey has gotten, like, you know, there's an investment in that security. Mexico City, you go to Roma, Condesa, you know, and you feel safe because there is a lot of policing. So to what extent the government needs to think about a strategy that also considers, you know, these class issues and to address that situation, because I think that that's a major situation happening in Mexico. The other thing is I read this article by Fernando Escalante, I think, at Nexos magazine long ago, but it's still, he argued, he analyzes violence in Mexico, that in places where the military has been deployed, states where the military has been deployed, there are some indications of higher levels of violence. And the reason he speculated, because I don't think there is a lot of evidence on that, is that when the military comes, it changes the power relationships at the local level, because the power groups, you know, they don't have the same amount of power, or so that people tend to take, you know, the justice by themselves too. I mean, apart from organized crime, so that it really creates more violence. So that's one of the questions I have in the intelligence of really deploying the military as the best strategy in that regard. Thank you very much.
So Wanda first, and then Duncan, just answer any or all of the comments or the questions.
Well, sure. Tamaulipas is one of the places with big shale gas reserves and one of the key areas for Mexico's energy, as you will hear probably in more detail from Duncan. And certainly the Peña administration has been very active in Tamaulipas. They have made major deployments. They have responded. Now, it would not be fair to say that they ignore the issues. I think the bigger problem is that they responded after high-value targeting helped trigger fighting and transfer fighting there between the Zetas and their rivals. And so my frustration is not that they're not doing enough in Tamaulipas, but that there continues to be series of hits essentially on the basis of random, and all, it's not fair to say completely random, but on the basis of opportunistic intelligence flows without consideration. Well, if we arrest this data leader here, we can expect this kind of vacuum to emerge and these drivers to push in. So we need to preposition forces then to deter or respond. That is not happening. So the level of strategic intelligence analysis continues to be lacking, and thinking about what kind of interdiction hits will trigger what kind of power contestation. So they're doing a lot. There's a lot of force in Tamaulipas. The question is how effective that force is. There are both federales, federal police, as well as the military. And one of the big recommendations I make in the point in a fair bit of detail is to move away from high-value targeting to focus on middle-level targeting, which is the way interdiction is done in the United States, in Great Britain, in Germany. But I also discussed that the reason why they have not been able to move to that is because it requires a certain institutional robustness, and it requires a trust in one's own institution that intelligence will not leak out. And given the extraordinary level of penetration of police forces, including at the very high federal levels, by organized crime, this trust is not there. What essentially one wants to do is to arrest as much of the middle layer that makes a criminal group function as one at once as possible. But that might mean sitting on intelligence for months and months. That also risks that intelligence will leak out. It's very tempting to get a signal hit on a capo and go arrest him because it's symbolic, because it has moral value. But it's also a very risky strategy, as we have seen. But to move away to more strategic interdiction, as much as that needs to happen, such as middle layer targeting, requires not just strategic planning, but it also requires enough vetting and credibility of an institution to be willing to sit on intelligence for months and months before one moves. Margaret, yes, you know, federalism complicates all manner of issues in Mexico, including public safety, but I also think that it's not prohibitive. So the United States as a federal system has an extremely fragmented law enforcement, and in fact, the key to law enforcement reform in the U.S. was precisely federalism. You come out of the 40s, 50s with very, very corrupt local police forces. And it was Bobby Kennedy, who deserves much credit, using the FBI and the justice system to force down anti-corruption measures and use the federal system to improve corrupt police forces. So, yes, it complicates things, but the critical issue is that the federal level continually presses, works with, listens to input from local institutions to move on resolving local policing issues. And this cannot be just sporadic. This needs to be robust and maintained across administration because police reform under the most auspicious circumstances takes a decade. It takes a generation of officer to change, and Mexico is working from not very auspicious circumstances. And yes, you know, the comment about policing and class is true not just about Mexico, but it's true about Latin America in general. The rich can rely on private security forces or perhaps design special institutions like the Fuerza Civil, but also often with very limited resources. There is a reason why the force is so small, because the rich in Monterrey are no longer interested in paying the extra tax for hiring more. And the poor often rely on the criminals themselves for street policing. As much as the criminals are the source of violence, they often suppress certain levels of predatory crime. They are the principal arbitrator of life on the street. And that needs to change in Mexico.
Just to touch on Bill's point, I think that it would be highly problematical if you, as a government, said, look, we know there's a lot of oil on the ground, we want to bring in the oil companies, so we're going to suppress violence, we're going to use all of our resources to stabilize Tamaulipas because that's what we want the oil companies coming. It's not going to look good for a start. And second of all, if you did do that, there's a good chance the oil companies wouldn't come anyway, because the problems of doing business in northern Mexico go far beyond just security. It's about dealing with local institutions that don't necessarily function. It's about dealing with the lack of infrastructure, which you need either there in place already or that you work with the local authorities to put in place. And the third point I make there is that the big money in the short term is not going to be made in shale anyway. The big money in the short term is going to be made offshore and in some of the mature fields that exist onshore but in a different part of the country. Now, does that mean it's not a challenge? Absolutely. It's a big challenge, and that's one of the things that the government needs to work with. And it's one of the questions I get most frequently when I'm speaking to oil companies is, you know, what do we have to worry about with regards to security in Mexico? But in fact, they're more concerned about the rule of law, respecting contracts, property rights, than they are about security. Because let's face it, they do business in all parts of the world that are more complicated. And just to emphasize Margaret's point, I think the federalism is a major factor here. And in fact, I think it's not just that it's a federal country, it's the process of decentralization of power that Mexico has experienced over the past 30 years or so that led to a situation where you devolved power to state and local governments without demanding any higher standards of transparency and accountability, where you've given them increasingly more money. And in fact, the PRI as a party, when it was in opposition, was one of the parties that really drove this. You know, and one of the reasons why the power base for the party remains at the local and state level. And it makes it very difficult to take it back at this point. And the Mexican government makes the point that there are constitutional limits to its power. Absolutely there are. But there are also exceptions, or rather other kinds of pressure and force that you can use to change the situation. One of my, one of the most respected analysts of Mexican security, Alejandro Ope, has made the point that there's also a moral hazard problem here, which is that if the federal government goes into every state which is failing in terms of security, then all the other states have no incentive to fix the problem themselves. Now, I don't know whether that argument actually follows through, but I think there is a good point there. But perhaps it comes down to more than just the moral hazard. It's about resources. There are limited resources in Mexico. You can't cover all of Tamaulipas, Michoacán, Guerrero, and still hope to implement your public security strategy in the rest of the country.
I think we have the middle back, then the front, and then to Abe. So,
thanks, Bernardo Rico of the World Bank IFC. Thanks for the great presentation. Given that the private sector in Mexico is experiencing, maybe it's more of a perception than reality, a big renaissance in its economic growth, a lot of it being pushed through by reforms from the current government. How does the private sector, particularly the large companies, having people like one of the most wealthiest human beings on this planet, reconcile this kind of renaissance in its economy with the events that continue to happen, with continued significant institutional weakness, crime and violence, and the recent events? And how do they see their role in actually helping to solve the problem?
Front and then back. Right over here.
Thank you. Thank you, Wanda, for an excellent report. Thank you to Harold and Duncan. Study after study, analyst after analyst have emphasized the tremendous challenge that corruption and impunity pose for any anti-crime and violence strategy in Mexico and elsewhere. You mentioned the case of Iguala, just the most recent, of which brings about the idea of doing something about corruption and impunity in Mexico. President Peña Nieto has talked about forming, reaching another pact with the political parties and doing something about corruption. What do you think? To what extent can it be done in terms of really for the first time in the last 8 years doing something serious and effective to fight corruption and impunity in Mexico? Thank you.
And if we can get one more question from Abe Lowenthal. And back to the panel.
Thank you. Abe Lowenthal from both Brookings and the Wilson Center. I'm interested in asking about the U.S. role. Is there a significant role in this issue area for the United States, unacknowledged or acknowledged, civilian or military, governmental or non-governmental? if so, how would you characterize it, and do you have any recommendations for improving it?
Back. Ben?
Sure. The reaction of the business community or broadly elite in Mexico to the violence, I think, has been very varied. To a large extent, people who live in Mexico City have been, with some exceptions, quite immune and removed from a lot of the violence. One of the consequences of violence not being uniform and not affecting everyone with same intensity or not affecting everyone, period, is that those with sufficient deep pockets can respond by hiring private security companies, or they don't even come into contact. Now, in other areas, we have seen that the business community was a key actor in mobilizing response. Monterey would be a prime example. In Ciudad Juarez as well, it was a combination of business community and civil society. To what extent they can be replicated elsewhere in Mexico is a big question, and in both places the situation has improved but is hardly resolved. And we are seeing the limitations typical of when the situation stops burning so acutely, taxpayers, whether they are middle class or they are the upper classes, stop being motivated to be spending extra money on security, Monterey, and the limitations and lack of expansion of the Fuerza Civil, and even a lot of weakening of the momentum in Ciudad Juarez, where it was also very much linked to Todo Somos Juarez and the end of the program under the Peña Nieto administration, also led to lots of the civil society groups, business groups in the city losing the energy and motivation they had when violence was critical. But nonetheless, the issue is how does one anchor in and use the energies and the resource capacity of the elite and the business community to push for reforms. Now, the other side of the business community, of course, is their sponsoring of militias. The militias are not just Michoacan and sort of peasant groups rising up. You have a lot of other cleansing going on in the country with private security companies moonlighting in various highly problematic behaviors, extrajudicial killings, and the business community has a role in that, and staying away from that, not resorting to that road is critical. My hope would be that the events of the summer will motivate a serious drive on redressing or starting to tackle corruption. It's not something that can happen quickly. And traditionally, when anti-corruption drives have been effective, is where they serve politically those who promoted them. But the key issue is making the jump from a political convenient tool, anti-corruption, to something that becomes an inadvertent habit. And that not often happens in countries. And we are yet to see that. Now, the good thing that Mexico has, as Duncan pointed out, is a big, robust civil society demand for accountability, demand for transparency, compared to a lot of other countries that tackle corruption with far weaker civil society base to push for it. But it's a long-term process that has not had often the robustness of political support that it needs. Especially in a system which is deeply corrupt, pervasively so, the question is how does one create sustainable momentums that can spread beyond sort of pockets of individuals that might make a difference perhaps in a local area, but nonetheless will end up being by the system, and how one then politically rewards the anti-corruption efforts. So for anti-corruption to be effective, it needs to start generating political benefits, strong political benefits for its sponsors. And we are yet to see that in Mexico. And yes, I think there are many opportunities for the U.S. to engage. The United States has been engaged. Certainly, there's been drop-off in the Mexican desire for U.S. engagement under the Peña administration compared to the Calderon administration, while they are continuing calls for reducing demand for drugs, cracking down on money laundering, cracking down on arms trafficking. Those are all good goals, and the policies can be perhaps made more robust. But frankly, there is no way that demand reduction in the U.S. will resolve Mexico's problems, because it's not going to drop. There are limitations to what even more robust efforts on arms trafficking can accomplish. And the key is to bring more effective law enforcement to Mexico. And that's something that U.S. can assist in helping Mexico build institutions, but ultimately it has to happen in Mexico. It's not something that the U.S. can do on its side.
Let me just make a quick point about resilient communities in the private sector. You know, the example of Monterrey is very telling, which is that it's the industrial heartland. It's the wealthiest part or the greatest concentration of wealth in Mexico. And that city fell to violence in a way that nobody expected. What was extraordinary is how it came back again afterwards. And that's where the concept of resilience becomes so important. It's not about resisting violence. It's not about resisting organized crime. That's what you need strong institutions for. It's whether a community is strong enough to come back afterwards. Monterrey showed it was possible to do that, but under very, very specific circumstances where you had the three levels of government, the private sector, and the civil society working together, largely because civil society is financed almost exclusively by the private sector in that city. Now, if you look at the area of Monterrey known as San Pedro Garza, one of the wealthiest areas of the country, which also has a very poor neighborhood or poor neighborhoods in it, what they've done moving ahead is to recognize that you cannot just make the richer areas safer. You have to actually take care of all the areas around it as well. So there are a lot of community-based programs there right now which are trying to help local kids stay in school. They're trying to provide employment opportunities, etc. And it seems to be having an impact in a very small area, a very, very small area. But that's something which, you know, gives us hope. Now, there was a paper that we published earlier on this year as part of a book on resilient communities by Matthew Ingram. And he looked at, and this speaks to Miriam's point earlier on, his argument is that if you just focus on making areas wealthier, in fact, security deteriorates in the short term. And why is that? Because if this area is wealthy and it's surrounded by poorer areas, then everybody comes in to steal stuff from you. It's logical. And so what you have to do is you have to adopt regional approaches to security. And that's what the polygonal approach was partly based on, but also what the role of the private sector has to be. They did a similar thing, I would say, not just in Ciudad Juarez, but in Tijuana with an initiative called Tijuana Innovadora, which has been very successful in bringing about sustained economic growth to that city. So the private sector can play a big role. Patricia's point about corruption and impunity, I mean, the incentive structure is out of whack, isn't it? I mean, if you have a 3% chance of actually ever being convicted for a murder, you know, there's not a lot keeping you from murdering somebody if that's what you want to do. I'm not saying that everybody wants to murder, but if that's, you know, if that's going to make you some money or if that's going to get you ahead. Now, that's where I think justice reform becomes so important. I mean, that's the institutional reform that more than any other, I would say, at this point in time, needs to be a focus of the Peña Nieto administration, recognizing that it's going to take a lot longer than this administration to make it work. They've got to make every effort right now to move towards that deadline of 2016, and they're not going to make it, but you say you get as much done as you possibly can, you keep working on it, you don't put this down afterwards. That's where the federal government can really push with local and state-level governments. And Abe's point about the U.S. or a question about the U.S. role, I would say that intelligence sharing has been fundamentally important in terms of the high-value targeting. But if you look at the four pillars of the Merida initiative, they're still highly relevant today. I mean, one of the ideas was building resilient communities. Another one is strengthening institutions, training. And the early days of the Peña Nieto administration was a difficult time for the bilateral relationship in security. There was a lot of kind of feeling out and distrust, particularly from the Mexicans towards the Americans. That apparently has improved a great deal in recent months. Now there seems to be a much healthier relationship between the two, and programs to do with training are moving ahead in a positive way. And I think, you know, there's been learning on both sides. The Americans have learned that there's only so far they can push, because ultimately it's the Mexicans who can decide what's possible. And the Mexican side has learned that they do actually benefit a great deal from the particularly intelligence sharing and training.
Thank you. I think front row and then right behind.
I'm a risk specialist. My name is Monica Dorhai, and I'm a risk specialist in banking sector, but I'm also an anti-corruption and safeguard specialist. I have a PhD on anti-corruption and also economics, so it's double. My question to you is, there are many attempts in Mexico to have anti-corruption or anti-crime strategies or pushes or fights. What is it that's just, why is different? And I would like to, if you can phrase this question in terms of state versus federal or local versus federal, you know, whether that the governors or the, you know, leaders of provinces are really, or is it just a push from, and by the way, very, very good job, Vanda. We love you. We need to have more of this, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think in the next row in back.
Mike Macedic, PBS Online NewsHour. Even though you admonished us not to get too wrapped up in the headlines at the moment are that the president's in a lot of political trouble. Where do you see this playing out? Does this mean that the members in the Congress are going to pay less attention to him? Because presumably his term goes on no matter what. It's not a parliamentary system. And the fact that you have this huge head of steam at the moment in the populace, but does that just sort of blow over and then we're sort of more back to business as usual?
I think there's one more.
Hello, my name is Laura Tuesta. I'm a professor in the drug policy program in the Centro de Investigación y Docencia Económica in Mexico. I have a question about the deployment of the federal police and how effective it could be. And it's getting into your point that I think you guys didn't answer. That is, it seems that they already implemented a lot of military operations in Mexico, and I don't think the results were good. Actually, there's some experiments that they took out all the municipal police and they put all the federal police in place, and it didn't work at all. So I'm wondering, when you are talking about putting the federal police in place, what should be different? What happened when they did it the first time and it didn't work? So why is it going to be working this time?
Since we're getting close to the end of our time, maybe we can take the one more in the back row and then come back to the...
Hi, Mike Lasusa. I'm from the Security Assistance Monitor. Excuse me. I was hoping that you could talk a little bit more about the Auto Defensa movement and how that plays into your argument about police reform. When people just take up arms and basically reject the police, what do you do in that situation? How would you address that?
Okay, and we actually have... Okay, we have two more people who want to go. Do we just take one big round?
Let's do it.
Yeah, okay. I think there's one more up here. Desmond, do you want to?
Yeah. Okay. Hey, thank you for calling on me. This was a really interesting discussion. I was wondering about, given the changes in crime control issues that are affecting Mexico today, how this is affecting Mexico's ability to control migration from Central America into Mexico and Mexico into the United States.
And I think we have one last word here in the front row. Right up here.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm Carolina Ayala from the Mexican Embassy. It's not a question, it's just a brief comment. It is clear that we face a lot of challenges, but I just want to mention that Mexico, as you all know, has passed very important reforms that we expect will contribute to improve conditions in Mexico, economic, social conditions, conditions as a whole that we translate also in safety conditions. For example, I just want to mention that we reform our criminal law, and instead of having 33 state codes, criminal codes, we just have one national code, which I think it's very important. And also, the political reform now allows for re-election of municipal authorities, which I think will contribute to accountability, that it's very important. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. So let's go back to Duncan. Do you want to go first this time?
Yeah, okay.
And then
let me just pick up a couple of the things. I mean, first of all, Mike, you know, your point is the movement going to play out? What's the next step for the government? We hope that the government takes the reaction from Mexican society as an opportunity to engage with them and to actually to redouble efforts. To date, I don't think we've seen too many encouraging signs on that, but we hope that there are conversations going on behind closed doors that will allow them to do that. I mean, somebody mentioned the idea of a pact for security earlier on. That's something that the problem is that you can't really deal with the other political parties at this point in time because they're so weak and divided themselves. The PRD is having a legitimacy crisis. The PAN has been pulling itself apart because of the leadership contest. So who do you actually deal with? This has to ultimately come down, I think, to the federal government to go out there and to listen to society and start to say, look, that we actually have a lot of the tools already in place. The justice reform, the mando único, we've got to push on those. We've got to give them the resources that they need. One of the questions that you asked, though, was, you know, what happens with the movement now? And I think there's an important date to remember here, which is that we're just under a month away from December 12th. And December 12th being, you know, the Festival of the Virgin of Guadalupe. You know, that's the beginning of the Christmas celebrations in Mexico, really. And things will really begin to wind down around that point. You know, any kind of sustained social movement is going to not fall apart, but, I mean, people's enthusiasm will diminish. And let's face it, Mexican society doesn't really come back until around the January the 15th. That's a long gap to sustain a social movement. I think you're going to have the hardcore people who will remain committed, but there's going to be a lot of distractions in between. And so that's something, to look out there for there. Mike's point, the question about the autodefenses, I think it's a very, very important question because it highlights one of the strengths of Mexico society, not the kind of strength that you want necessarily, but I think it points to the importance of engaging with society, which is if you don't give Mexican society the right kind of tools to resist and to be resilient to organized crime, they'll find their own way. That's what we saw in Michoacán. And then, of course, that creates a whole other range of problems. And so the autodefenses problem has not gone away in any sense. It's still there in Michoacán. Some of them have been disarmed. Other ones have sprung up. It's spread in some ways to other states. That's something which I think we need to keep a tab on. And the last point, which is about transmigration, Central American migrants. It's a very, very big problem, and the weakness of police institutions, the weakness of the justice system, only compounds that problem because these people are essentially unprotected on their journey through Mexico in so many ways. In many senses, at least in the past, they've been fallen prey to the institutions of public security, to police and corrupt justice systems. And again, it emphasizes why, you know, not in isolation, but one of the most important things you can do is to strengthen both the justice system and police systems.
Thank you. Vanda?
Let me pick up with the border issue. Lots of the recent policing efforts in Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez, particularly Tijuana, have partially responding to U.S. pressures focused on migrants that were returned from the United States, often in ways that I think were counterproductive, and almost policing would be social cleansing in core business areas, while policing in the colonias continue to be very limited. So although there seems to be a level of responsiveness or satisfaction, in my view, lots of the local policing having to do with border management has actually not been effective and has picked up a vulnerable group of people, perhaps violating laws to some extent, but certainly not being the predominant source of problems, and yet it would make the city centers in Tijuana seem cleaner, while the colonias continue to struggle with tremendous problems. in the south, the border is very porous. Yes, the Mexican government has committed itself to tightening the border. U.S. has been putting a lot of pressure on them to do so. In practice, they really cannot. And my expectation is that one consequence simply will be upping the level of bribery that needs to be paid to state institutions and the level of abuse that migrants will face. So I'm fairly skeptical about the southern border efforts. And one of the risks, in fact, is that perhaps that could even create strengthening of relations between local communities and migrants and organized crime groups. The Zetas are around, certainly the Sinaloa are there. They have, these areas have not exploded into violence, but I would posit it has nothing to do with good policing, and these areas are very vulnerable into exploding to violence. Meanwhile, the migrants are being caught, and what's being done on the border is not, in my view, getting at the core issues of weak deterrence, weak law enforcement, weak accountability. Look, my take on the police is what I had said before. I don't really have so much problem with sending the federal police in, even sending the military. Often local municipal police are rotten. They're weak and corrupt, and one cannot work with them until something changes. The key problem, in my view, is what kind of mandate are they sent in with to do specifically what? And that has been lacking. There is a crisis, so sending the federales and sending the military to do what? Check cars, set up checkpoints and check routes? Really not going to get at the core issue. The length of the deployment, the transition when the situation is quote-unquote resolved, which it almost never is, but when violence seems to go down, how do you hand over to whom? That's what needs to take place. I don't see that one can escape from using the military anytime soon, or for that matter, the federal police. The question is with what mandates, what kind of cooperation, what kind of institutional anchoring in local prosecutors' offices they are sent in with. And the relationship to violence is, of course, highly complex. They are often sent to areas where violence has started escalating to start with. Then they make a bunch of interdiction and arrest, which only up violence further. But nonetheless, to say that they are simply the trigger of violence is perhaps not fair. And let me then link that to the militias or autodefensas. I think it's an extremely unhealthy development for Mexico. It's not new. Militias have been in Mexico in one form or another for decades and decades. It's also not new in Michoacán or Guerrero. They have existed. They are visible today. And they are, sadly, in my view, becoming more popular. If one looks at polling nationwide as well as Michoacán and Guerrero-specific polling, the support for the autodefensas has risen over the past year and a half among the Mexican public. Very much symptomatic of the lack of faith in the state to deliver security, but it's also extremely unhealthy. And the Mexican government, I think, has reacted fairly reasonably in suggesting that they have to be folded into the state if they cannot be stopped altogether. And now the question is how effective the state will be in delivering on the arrangements that have been made, that have been violated in Michoacán. Many of the groups did not disarm. They did not follow the terms of the agreement, and they continue existing.
Okay, well, I think we're just about at the end of our time. If you don't have any final comments to make.
Just one comment about the anti-corruption, which we didn't touch on, which is that I think that, you know, you can say that Mexico has had a lot of success in some anti-corruption at the federal level. You know, things are a lot better in Mexico than they were 20 years ago. They're a lot better than they were 10 years ago, to be honest with you. If you go back 10 years, in the early years of the Fox administration, you know, you had the drug czar being directly linked to organized crime. You know, you don't find that anymore in Mexico. That's a big success, but that hasn't happened at the state and local level. And in part, that's because of the decentralization of power without subsequent or consequent improvements in accountability and transparency in those governments.
And so that's a major challenge moving ahead, is you have to try to sort that out throughout the country. You know, they're doing it at the level of the federal government was the easy part in many ways. And you probably have to pick your battles pretty carefully, because you can't attack the problem across the country in one go. And so dealing with particularly difficult areas, whether it's Tamaulipas or with, you know, in Guerrero, should probably be a priority.
Thank you, Duncan, for taking us out on a slightly more optimistic note. And thank you all for joining us to discuss Vanda Felbat-Brown's new paper on security in Mexico, one of many different reforms that the Peña Nieto administration is undertaking. And please download it or grab a copy on the way out, because I think you'll find it a great read with some very thoughtful policy recommendations. And thank you all. Thank you to Duncan for joining us, and thank you to Vanda as well for writing a wonderful paper.
Thank you. Very nice of you.